Here is the Album of Manhattan, Word Pictures of the Big City by Louis Sobel, the popular columnist of the New York Journal-American and syndicated newspapers. It's a large album in which candid shots taken only a few hours ago are side by side with curious views of yesterday. And sometimes there's a picture behind the picture, an untold story of Broadway that Louis Sobel brings to us for the first time. You're invited to look and to listen as he turns the pages. Mr. Sobel.
Gather around me, ladies and gentlemen of America, and make yourselves comfortable while I open my album of Manhattan. I have pictures here, some new, some old, of people and places, of old and new faces. This fellow here, for instance, I'd be willing to wager the name is new to most of you. Don Freeman, he's not 30 yet, who came to New York from San Diego way to make a living with pencil and drawing paper, sketching personalities of the theater for the newspapers. No great fortune has ever been acquired drawing on a freelance basis for New York newspapers. But Freeman has been plugging on, and in between times, painting sketches of New York. And now, this week, there is an exhibition of his art, lithographs and oil paintings, sharply done vignettes of the Manhattan scene, broad pastels of metropolitan twilights, and of laundrymen climbing tenement stairs. New York has suddenly become aware of a new genius in Don Freeman, and New York likes to make its discoveries. And most of us have been trooping down to the galleries on Fifth Avenue to inspect canvases bearing such illuminating titles as Chorus Girls Under Stage, Broadway Blizzard, Six Flights Up, Cops on a Corner, Wants to be Arrested, Harlem Summer, and so forth. The boy who came from San Diego to draw cartoons for New York papers now finds himself hailed by fellow artists. And this amazing thing is occurring. The artists themselves are among those buying his drawings, outbidding the lay patrons. In fact, I overheard one artist say he was buying a Freeman painting with money he could ill afford. Why, I asked them, since you're an artist yourself, don't you make a deal with him? Trade him one of yours for one of his. The fellow shook his head. It wouldn't be a deal, he said. In a few years from now, Freeman's work will be fetching top prices. Mine will never go places. An exhibition of artistic candor, if nothing else. Here we have a handsome young woman. Not a new face by any means. She's Tallulah Bankhead, Alabama rear, daughter and granddaughter, niece and grandniece of statesmen who have served their state and country for generations. Of all the gifted and spirited and startling conversationalists, I'd place the tempestuous Tallulah top high. Just before she left for her tour, I sat with her in the Stork Club. Outside of an occasional yes, and is that so, and you don't say, I rested mute while the fetching lady poured out buckets full of her sparkling word burgundy, covering every subject from stage and baseball and Finland's plight to her distinguished papa's genial eccentricity. It was a machine gun monologue. It held me spellbound, I admit. But I couldn't help but recalling at one point the acerbic Mr. Howard Dietz's comment, very often quoted, a day without Tallulah Bankhead is like a month in the country. Here you have another handsome lady. You and I have read and heard occasional references to her. Greta Garbo is the name she prefers, and unlike the tantalizing Tallulah, the gorgeous Greta has achieved a reputation for taciturnity and aloofness. Yet, when I spied in on her at a corner table upstairs in the 21 Club a few weeks ago, the glum-go-homish Greta was pouring out an animated monologue between spoonsful of salad. She does eat salad with a spoon, by the way. And I never saw lips move so rapidly or so many words come tumbling out at one time while her escort, an amiable gentleman named Dr. Gaylord Hauser, listened and nodded, nodded and listened. It was the end for this reporter, at least, of one grand illusion. More recently, I saw her scurry into a car followed by the same Dr. Hauser. This was at Palm Beach, and this time, glum Greta was silent, anxious to escape the lens of the cameraman. These pictures you see now are of places you have read about in the papers, and perhaps some of you have visited them and had, or imagined you have had, a hilarious time. Here is the Stork Club with Sunday night debutantes and bankers and college boys scrambling madly for floating balloons containing prizes. And this is the famed Jack and Charlie's 21, with the cameo profile George Jean Nathan at his favorite corner table, and the bearded Monty Woolley who came to dinner and forgot to eat it, leaning gloomily against the bar. And here is El Morocco with its zebra-striped divan in the lobby, and the swanky, glittery Monte Carlo, the Colony restaurant, and the rowdy beachcombers, the Diamond Horseshoe dedicated to nostalgic memories of another decade, and the colorful gay 90s, with its walls cluttered up with age-yellowed programs and song sheets and posters of long-forgotten melodramas. These are pictures of boisterous Leon and Eddie's and Jack White's 18 Club. And here you have the whole row of bistros which make up the noisy street known as Swing Lane, more formally as 52nd Street. But across the Broadway line, down on 46th Street between 8th and 9th Avenues, there too are bars and tiny cafes that few of the so-called Manhattan sophisticates frequent. Here, instead of bands, a slot machine, phonographs, blare forth waltzes, and foxtrots. And the patrons are mostly of French ancestry. The tarred trumpets and clarinets of the Artie Shaws and the Dorsey Brothers, of the Benny Goodmans and the Glenn Millers, are ignored in favor of recordings of a groaning accordion or a squeaky concertina. Nothing fancy about these places. But drop in some Friday or Saturday night and be surprised. I was. By the fun these folks have at prices which the waiters at the snootier cafes would spurn as tips. Here the two-step is preferred to the more feverish shag. One place on the block which couldn't afford the price of a liquor license concentrates on apple cider and a non-alcoholic French cordial, a sweet, sticky drink favored by the girls. Here I saw two excitable Frenchmen get into a stormy fistfight in a competition at a pinball machine. The argument started when one ridiculed the low score of the other. The manager heaved them both out, while a middle-aged, coy singer droned on, undisturbed, with a song about the wonders of Paris. You don't have to guess more than once about this next picture. That's right, William S. Hart. I saw him only a few nights ago, tall, tight-lipped, gloomy as usual, and alone as usual, too. There will never be a Western movie hero for me like this fellow Hart, and I say this with due respect to some Western heroes, past and present, a few of whom I include among my personal friends. I have seen Tom Mix shoot from the hip, in pictures, I mean, and Harry Carey hold off a posse, and Bronco Billy shoot up a saloon, but there has never been the thrill that was in those early days of the silence when this fellow Hart, unsmiling, grim, whipped out two guns and shot the Western bullies down in that track. Now, I see William S. Hart often, sometimes at the tavern, occasionally at Dempsey's, and I have in my possession books which he has sent me with nice personal messages autographed on the inside covers, but I have never had the courage in all these years to walk over and say hello to him. I'm glad even that I have never heard him speak. It might spoil an illusion. And speaking of illusions, all these fellas you see here in these album pages now would spoil yours. A gloomy lot, if ever there was one. These, ladies and gentlemen, are the funny men of America. Burt Law, Ed Wynn, Phil Baker, Jack Benny, half a dozen others. I never heard an unfunnier lot in my life in private conversation, nor have I seen a more nervous or glummer group. There are exceptions. Eddie Cantor can be a comical fellow off-screen and off-air, and Georgie Jessel can hold you screaming for minutes at a time, and so can Joey Lewis. But as a whole, the professional comedians are not chaps I should want as my companions on a rainy afternoon when time hangs heavily and the radio isn't working. Let's move to the next page. Now, this place is a favorite retreat of mine, and someday, perhaps it will be glorified in play or in a book, which I hope not, for that would spoil its homely, intimate atmosphere. Ralph's is the name of the restaurant. It's on West 45th Street. And here, during any evening, you will find assembled the great and the near-great of the theater. Over Ralph's slightly frayed checkered tablecloth, between the soft hours of midnight and 3 a.m, gather the people of the theater to talk shop. And if you're lucky, you may eavesdrop on the small chatter of folk like Burgess Meredith and Margot Gilmore, or Clifford Odets and Orson Welles, of Blanche Ring and Miriam Hopkins. There was one night when I and Keith, with very little urging, recited 3/4 of Hamlet, assuming all the roles, and on another occasion, Gertrude Lawrence and Noel Coward acted out a 3-minute skit that touched Ralph the proprietor so deeply he ordered drinks on the house for everyone in the place. Ralph's affiliation with the theater isn't limited to being the boniface of a barroom patronized by his favorites. Over his establishment are tiny rooms which he rents out to the struggling actors. And though the beds aren't like those in the Ritz, nor the rooms furnished with walled-off elegance, nevertheless there is comfort for the tenants and home-like attention. Many old-timers still get their mail here, and they say, although I haven't verified this, that a fine old gentleman wandered in one night and asked timidly, was there a letter for him? What is your name, he was asked. Softly and politely, he answered, William Faversham. Of the young gentlemen and ladies who form the vast and aggressive army of autograph seekers who mill around theater lobbies and nightclubs on opening nights, one gallant young fellow rates a bow for his originality. Vincent Lavelli is his name, and he spurns the common garden variety of pencil scrawls by the eminent who have their names in the marquee lights or in newspaper headlines. Lavelli devotes himself to the fairer sex and asks nothing from them in the way of the usual signature. Instead, to achieve distinction in Mr. Lavelli's imitation leather book, you must press the imprint of your rouged lips on the page reserved for you. Mr. Lavelli prides himself upon being able to identify you by your type of lip rouge. Among his lip imprint conquests have been Miss Carmen Miranda, Mary Martin, the Andrews sisters, Anne Shirley, Dorothy L'Amour, Francis Langford, and Vinay Venuta. He admits dolefully that the page reserved for Miss Marlena Dietrich still remains chastely white and unsullied by the lip rouge imprint. But Mr. Lavelli is young and ambitious, and he does not give up easily. Obviously, gentlemen of the theater and the public limelight are not invited to contribute to young Mr. Lavelli's valuable little book. Occasional stroller along Broadway's throbbing boulevard is a genial old gentleman who seems flattered when at rare intervals someone will hail him by name. David Warfield, almost a legendary figure now. Once among the notables of the theater, I have never seen him at an opening night, nor for that matter in any of the popular restaurants or nightclubs. He is content to spend quiet hours at the Lambs Club, where he is something of a privileged person, and on a few occasions will take a walk with another old-timer and exchange a few reminiscences of the days when he was the star of The Music Master. Hollywood and Broadway producers have tried again and again to entice him back for one more performance, but Warfield shakes his head. Unlike other stars of his generation, his investments were shrewd and careful, and today he is rated among Manhattan's wealthiest. New York restaurants go in for pictures to emphasize their personality. Sardi's, for instance, has its walls covered with caricatures of notables by the young Russian genius Alex Gard. The Warwick's Raleigh Room boasts Dean Cornwell murals bordered by the crests of famous writers, authors, artists, statesmen, show people, and so forth. Gallagher's favors pictures of sports and political personalities. The Tavern is more sedate, reserving its panels of honor for the presidents of the United States, from George Washington through to President Roosevelt. And currently, there have been mild wagers whether the empty panel next to Roosevelt's will have a new face after next election or be forced to remain barren until the election following. I sat the other night under the portrait of Abraham Lincoln, and as I studied the lined, careworn features, I was reminded of what Carl Sandburg had to say of him. He was 30 pounds underweight, his cheeks haggard, yet the inside of him moved to a music of peace on earth and goodwill to men. It is a far cry from Lincoln to Broadway personalities. But that very night, within an hour of each other, I ran into George S. Kaufman and George Abbott. And it occurred to me that here were two of the more careful among the talented gentlemen of the theater. Theirs is the magic touch. And the barest suspicion that an Abbott or a Kaufman is serving in a directorial or play surgical role will crowd the opening nights with the discriminating elite of town. Occasionally, they have their flops, great big ones that land with a sickening thud. But as a rule, the flops are few because Kaufman and Abbott won't permit a play to come to Broadway if it reveals faltering qualities in the out-of-town tryout. Kaufman is caustic. Abbott is smoother, diplomatic, but ruthless. Kaufman is a quick wit. Abbott's humor is less spontaneous and certainly milder. It was Kaufman who, when Paramount wired, will offer $100,000 for rights to Dinner at 8, promptly wired back, will offer $100,000 for rights to Paramount. Well, I see we've come to the last page of this week's Album of Manhattan. But the book will be filled again by next week. Please join me then on Wednesday night. And until then, happy going.
Louis Sobel has closed the pages of his Album of Manhattan for tonight. But he'll open the volume again next Wednesday evening at 9:15 Eastern Standard Time for listeners over many of these stations. We hope that you'll accept Mr. Sobel's invitation to join him then as he looks over views of the people and places whose stories are so vividly a part of the life of this big city. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.